Assalamu alaikum, Sister Asma, and all the listeners. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm Zainab Sadat, and I have my MA in English Language Teaching, TFL.
So great. And you, Sister Bittu?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And actually, I have the pleasure to be here today with you too, my dear friends, and also our dear listeners here. It's a big pleasure for me. So I'm Bita, and I'm a medical student at Sheikh Bashir University. And also, I'm here at your service for today's discussion.
Well, in today's episode, we're going to talk about the production of movies in the realm of religious ideas. So tell me about the religious movies you've seen and they have attracted your attention.
What came to my mind was the movie Heaven is for Real.
Yes.
You know, it was produced in 2014, I guess. It was based on a true story of a four-year-old boy called Colton Burpo, who was the son of Todd Burpo, the pastor of a church in Nebraska, in America. This four-year-old boy went through an appendix surgery, and his situation was quite dangerous and bad, that throughout the surgery, he lost his life for some seconds. And then in that interval, his soul went out of his body and he experienced death. He saw his mother asking other people to pray for her little son. He saw his father yelling at God. And he even went and visited some people he did not have any idea about. So all of these happen when the child is saved after that surgery, and he talks about the experience to his parents. He shares this experience on social media, and he has an interview.
A lot of documentaries and a lot of movies has been created from different nations.
Yes, but the most famous one is this one that I'm talking about.
There's also the thing that all these movies, they have a theme, of course, but the background for it is to make people more aware of the religion they have. You know?
I'm not a person who is that much interested in films or something, but there is one special story that I'm really interested about. That is the story of Prophet Yusuf, Joseph. That is very much interesting for me because this is the story of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, there are many beautiful contents in that story, like, for example, greed, like jealousy, like many things. For example, as you know, first Prophet Yusuf saw a dream about 11 stars and the sun and the moon that was somehow so interesting in the content of being somehow metaphysical in this way. And after that, the brothers started to grow kind of jealousy in their hearts towards this brother, and they did something wrong and wrong and wrong. And also, there is a beautiful paradoxical content of the beauty of your appearance and the beauty of your soul.
Exactly.
That, you know, that beauty, that physical beauty made him go to the prison, but the thing that freed him was actually his beauty of soul and behavior.
His virtues, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
And also there's another theme behind that TV series, which is the fact that no matter what people want, at the end, the thing that God has planned is going to happen. So they wanted him dead. They wanted their brother to be dead because they were so jealous of him. But what happened in the end?
He was the most famous person in Egypt, and that was amazing, I think.
He became the king.
Yeah. And I think this is not only a historical monument or something, this is something that you have to actually be patterned on our life, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to learn from these kind of stories. And these stories, I think, have the potential to actually be acted again and again. And we have to have more movies, I think,
from
these stories.
And there's another movie I would like to share in here.
I'm all ear.
Yes, it was Fathers 2. I'm not sure if you have seen it or not, but I recommend it too much
because
it was a very nice movie starring Mel Gibson and Mark Wahlberg. It was an amazing movie, and I guess the director was Mark Wahlberg himself. It was about a man who is trying his hand in different job, but in all of them he was a loser. Mm-hmm. Until a time he falls in love with a girl who's Catholic, and then she goes to the church so much, and then because of her he's been forced to go to church. The process of baptism and whatever, he went through all of them. And then because of the love of a girl, he started to fall for the church. And then he was coming and going so much. He started to go for some sessions until a time when he actually has an accident. And then after that accident, his life turned upside down. He saw the Virgin Mary telling him that you should be the follower of my son. Then after that, when he wakes up from his sickness, he comes to be studying priesthood, and then he becomes a priest. Just imagine a person who's having... he was a layman. He did not know anything. He was an ordinary man who was actually doing nothing in his life. They had a shattered family because the son of the family has been lost some years ago. So the entire family went apart because of that incident. And then at the end, he became a priest, and unbelievably, though he did not know the language, the pompous language of the priests and whatsoever, but he became a kind of a priest that was so down to earth, and all the people wanted to go for him in order to share their sins and whatever they do with him, because he just gave them the advices that was more practical and a worldly language, you know? He talked to them as if he was one of them. So the guy who thought he is useless turned out to be very much worthy and valuable when he came closer to his Lord, and he became the follower, the true follower of the Jesus after what Virgin Mary asked him to. So it was a nice movie, actually. A lot of themes was behind that. And the most important one was the fact that when you get closer to the Lord, your life is not getting any easier, because there's no promise as such, but you are going to change totally. Then you see your true self more clearly. So before we get into other aspects of these movies and their production, let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Welcome back. This is Back to Reality. We're talking about movies, about religious themes, and with the idea that they want to spread some ideas on the morality or spirituality. We actually gave some examples of the movies, and I'm sure that you know already there are plenty much of movies that go with the same intention to talk about morality and to have some religious backgrounds. I would recommend you, if you want to know more about some movies working on these religious themes, then you can go and listen to Viewpoints. In there, we have a program that works on different movies, and it will go for the criticism of different aspects of the movies that are working with the morality or religious aspects. You can check the archive of IRB English Radio, parstoday.com. Now, we know that there are plenty much of movies being done about some other religions. Now, in Islamic format, we do not have that much of movies because of there haven't been so much of work. Of course, there have been some efforts, but still we have to work on it more and more. Why do we have to work on these movies at first? Let's clear this one.
There are two groups of this movie that we can make. One of them is actually a special limited to Islam or something, and the other one is somehow some questions that human beings all around the world that we have about the potential of human being's soul.
So you are making them into two groups.
Yeah, exactly.
One morality and one humanity.
Yeah, that's nice. So first of all, I think the working widely around the world about the second group is somehow beautiful. We have many movies around the world, even from Islamic nation, about this part. But about mm-hmm. that part, I mean morality, I think, yes, we have a way to go for this road, a long way to go.
Exactly.
You know, and first of all, I think we need it. Unfortunately, religious theme or something is somehow actually risky for everybody to produce a movie without involving any of their own thoughts, you know? Yeah. And I think this is the main problem, that we don't go through these parts that much.
Yeah, that's very true, you know, because the producer of the TV series of Imam Ali alayhi salam or Imam Hassan alayhi salam has once, even Imam Rida alayhi salam, the producer said that it was so difficult for me. The burden was so much on me that after finishing these movies, I thought that I have to take a long rest because too much of pressure I felt when the movie was going on air. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's very much true. These movies are very much risky because they're working with the beliefs and creeds of people, you know? The creed of a nation is not something easy to play with. Yes. And these directors and these writers usually know the way how to work with the cords of your brain. You know what I mean?
You know, and they must be quite professional in that field. You know, an ordinary director might not be able to handle such serious matters and topics. The director has to have lots of experience in that genre.
Exactly. And they themselves must be religious enough to know all the aspects of the religion they're going to talk about, its morality or its humanity.
Because they would reflect their mentality throughout their movies.
So right now, let's put it in here and go for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We're talking about the production of movies in the realm of religious ideas. As I'm sure you're going to agree with me, these sort of movies, though they're very much risky and very much difficult to be created, but they have a great effect on people. And they might change some even wrong attitudes they have toward the religion or toward the morality that's been talked about.
They might affect a culture, in fact.
Exactly.
Yes, just as you said. Yes, the influence might be so wide that a huge number of people might change their attitude.
And of course, it's not just movies, you know. There are different formats of these sort of creations that would work. Like animations we have, like we have even documentaries. I've seen plenty much of documentaries that come to talk about different religion, different aspects of each religion, which is very much interesting. And also, we could have short clips and whatever.
Music, even in some
genres.
Even
music, yes. And you know that media is helping us. Nowadays, everything is pretty much easier. But the thing is, we have to go through too much of reading and studying in order to be able to make something which is valuable, not just a piece of a work.
Yes. And so, if you allow me, I want to add something. I think because the historical part of religion is somehow more bold in the society, and most of the movies or even musics with the religious theme has somehow a historical genre too. We have to make it more practical to just interest other people in this matter, actually.
You mean that we have to bring them into modern world?
Exactly. This is what I mean.
So that we attract audience.
Yeah.
So that's all the time that we had for today's episode. We talked about movies. We know that creating a movie, producing a movie, having a good writer in order to write a good synopsis for the movie that we intend to make is going to be a hard job. It is a drudgery. It needs so much of effort. But of course, it is going to have some fruitful effects on society and on people. So I hope we might have some more of these religious movies that are going to change a nation and have effects on everyone and spread humanity and kindness everywhere. Thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي
التي ما رايز again. Let us see daylight again once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank areas continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mehdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others. Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph Stump, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts.
Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The United States midterm elections began with many reminding that the party of the sitting president almost always loses seats in Congress. With inflation at a record high, economic instability the worst in decades, and the unrest in Ukraine quickly becoming America's latest forever war, early polling had many expecting a Republican red wave.
I think if the Republicans do win, it might be a dramatic shift. I can't really say for the better or for the worse. We just have to, you know, pop some popcorn and see what happens, you know.
The campaign was marked by each side accusing the other of being extremists. Republicans portrayed Democrats as cultural and economic radicals, whereas Democrats insisted that Republicans were intent on destroying American democracy. The mutual fear-mongering has led to 9 out of 10 Americans saying that they now fear politically related violence.
I'm just glad it's over. Said I'd like to get back to normal again somehow, some way. I hope they take it well because we've been through this one time before and they know what to expect, so I don't think there's that much to get excited about. I just hope we just go back to being good citizens again.
At the end of Election Day, which party will rule Congress was still in doubt, as an easy Republican victory was not apparent. The United States continues to have prolonged difficulties with counting votes, a major cause of the widespread doubt regarding the integrity of their electoral system. It may take days or possibly weeks to decide the final outcome, meaning that the United States is having another incredibly unstable election, with tension and division seemingly certain to increase.
If the Republicans, well, I just hope that they do the job like everybody else, be it Democrats, Republican, you name it. If people would just be for the people, really in the real sense of the word, I think that the world in general will be a better place.
Candidates on both sides have threatened to refuse to recognize the result if they aren't the winner, meaning that America's election day could drag into election month once again. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aids if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses, and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Mirzad, Kabul.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them and engaging with 6 concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into 3 main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only 4 or 5 countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships. The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement, which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs three different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan blocked the key avenues and roads leading towards country's capital Islamabad, causing massive traffic jams, halting logistics, and forcing schools and offices to close. Khan, who is demanding immediate elections, survived the assassination attempt last Thursday in the eastern Punjab province, leaving him wounded along with his several party workers. Police have arrested the suspected shooter and registered a case against him. However, Imran Khan and his supporters are not satisfied with it, demanding that Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a senior military official be investigated through a UN inquiry for their alleged involvement in the attack.
There's only one national leader whose name is Imran Khan. Everybody is behind him. We want free and fair investigation under United Nations investigation board.
The masses on the streets were urged due to the violent protest and road closures, asking authorities to end what they call the ongoing drama.
We are sick of such protest and unrest. Our lives and properties are not safe. Political parties should resolve their issues in the parliament instead of disturbing our lives on the streets.
While apologizing the masses over the current political uncertainty in the country, the government asked the PTI-led provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces to play their role in opening the roads to ease the life of the masses.
I apologize to the people affected by Imran Khan's long march and protests on behalf of the federal government. We strongly requested the provincial governments to open the national highways immediately.
Khan's party has announced that its anti-government march will be resumed on Thursday at the place where Khan was attacked.
The recent attack on former Pakistani Prime Minister has deepened the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Petra Bas Lip is the mother of Alina Lip, a journalist whom the German government is trying to imprison due to her reporting in Donbass. Like her daughter, she has fled Germany to Crimea due to persecution. The government recently arbitrarily closed her bank account.
First her bank account, then her father's bank account, and last mine. So, yeah.
And what does that do, closing down your bank account?
What does it? You must imagine, you can't buy your food anymore, you can't pay your rent, you can't pay your insurance, you can pay nothing from one moment to the other. So, what to do?
And the German, there was no legal decision over this, there was no court case, they just didn't even tell you, they just shut it down.
No, they didn't tell me. No, nothing.
How did you survive?
Yeah, I'm a creative person. I had some money, of course. I'm lucky, some cash. And they told me I can go to the church and to tell my story.
So the state told you that? The state told you to go to the church?
No, my bank officer told me that. Because I asked him, what shall I do now? And he told me, oh, maybe you can go to the church.
The German government is still attempting to imprison Alina Lip for her work in Donbass. Now, I've seen the court documents, and the reasons they give are that Alina has reported that Ukraine has been killing its own people in Donbass for 8 years, and that the majority of people there support Russia. Now, these are two undeniable facts. Perhaps the most worrying aspect of this case is that her court order effectively criminalizes honest reporting in Ukraine. Because if you're a journalist, mainstream or otherwise, or a political figure, and you want to point out these two very important facts, you risk going to jail, raising questions about Germany's ability to make sensible policies on Ukraine.
As they see Elena as an enemy of their narrative, her message as a threat, they want to make Elena's moves impossible by blocking the financial capability and creating a psychological pressure. They are distorting her focus out from the things what she were doing before, and I mean seeking the truth and telling the truth to the German audience, and that is their target. And when they are succeeding of disturbing her job, then they think that they are winning the battle.
Yes, I think that the governments in Europe, because I'm not the only case, prosecute the parents of journalists, because we, of course, get support of our parents. They support us maybe also. It's the fact that if they close my bank account, probably the parents will help out. For me, it's an act of suppressive state, or even terror state. I don't know what's going on in Germany now.
While WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange languishes in a British jail, and French journalist Adrien Bouquet recently survived an assassination attempt in Turkey, he suspects by the Ukrainian SBU, for Alina and her mother, it's exile. The threat to Western journalists who challenge the mainstream with uncomfortable truths is growing. Johnny Miller, Crimea.
England and Wales football associations are pushing ahead with plans to peddle political messages at this year's World Cup football tournament hosted by Qatar. In a joint statement with 8 other European federations, England and Wales insisted they will continue to press off-field issues in spite of a FIFA plea to focus on football.
National teams and their players choosing this sporting event to push their Western worldview so blatantly onto the Arab world is unprecedented, creating a culture war at an event which is supposed to remain free from politics.
Doha has come under fire for its human rights record, including poor treatment of migrant workers who built the competition's infrastructure. But the criticism also goes further, with activists attacking Qataris over their religious and cultural beliefs too, such as bans on alcohol, premarital relations, and Western LGBTQ culture. However, onlookers from the Muslim world have been less impressed by the anti-Qatar bandwagon.
We obviously know that they're very hypocritical, and, for example, on the Ukraine issue, basically politics is coming to sport, you know, when the West feels like it. But the West cannot have it its own way all the time. And this is a World Cup, the first World Cup in an Arab and Muslim country. They need to go there and respect the culture. Muslim sportsmen coming to the West do not necessarily, they don't insist that the West stops invading foreign countries before playing sport, or prohibit gambling and, you know, pornography and all this kind of stuff which is prevalent in the West, you know, because we realize that different countries have different cultures. And when you go to somebody else's country, you obey the law and you respect the country, you respect the local culture. And if you don't like it, you leave.
This is the first time that the World Cup has ever been hosted in the Middle East. Qatar's authorities have promised to provide a welcoming environment to all. This week, Doha's foreign minister responded angrily to what he called European arrogance and double standards. Many expect that activists on and off the pitch or stage protests throughout the competition. How Qatari authorities will police this remains to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
US President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the US cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of US presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Hamirzad, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Humanity is on a highway to climate hell. The UN Secretary General has warned, saying the fight for a livable planet will be won or lost in this decade. Antonio Guterres told world leaders at the opening of the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Egypt, saying, We are in the fight of our lives and we are losing. And our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Antonio Guterres singled out the United States and China as two nations with a particular responsibility to combat climate change. The world must choose whether to cut emissions or condemn future generations to a climate catastrophe. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned while speaking at the COP27 summit in Egypt. Humanity has a choice, cooperate or perish, Guterres told delegates gathered to discuss how to combat change amid an ongoing crisis between Russia and Ukraine and rising global inflation and energy shortages. Guterres insisted that the world's richest and poorest countries must form a pact to accelerate the transition from fossil fuels, singling out China and the United States as two countries that have a particular responsibility to join efforts to make this pact a reality. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing, global temperatures keep rising, and our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible, Guterres said, proclaiming that we are on a highway to climate hell, with our foot on the accelerator. The UN chief's warnings were seconded by former US Vice President Al Gore, who also emphasized the need to end the reliance on fossil fuels. We must see the so-called dash for gas for what it really is, a dash down a bridge to nowhere, leaving the countries of the world facing climate chaos and billions in stranded assets, especially here in Africa, he said. Guterres also pointed out that the world must achieve net zero emissions by 2050 if the signatories of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement wish to achieve their long-term goal of keeping global temperatures from rising by more than 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. Last week, teenage climate activist Greta Thunberg suggested battling climate change by eliminating capitalism, which she said was defined by colonialism, imperialism, oppression, and genocide by the so-called Global North. According to Guardian, more than 100 heads of state and government from around the world gathered in the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh for 2 days of closed-door meetings and public events to discuss the climate crisis. Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, will attend for 1 day along with Olaf Scholz of Germany, Emmanuel Macron of France, and Ursula von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission. Joe Biden, the U.S. President, will come later in the week after the U.S. midterm elections. Mia Mottley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, will set out a new initiative on climate finance for the developing world, and African leaders, including William Ruto of Kenya, Macky Sall of Senegal, and George Weah, the president of Liberia, are at the talks. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, is also at the meeting. The world leaders will hand over to officials and ministers for the rest of fortnight of talks. However, the summit promises to be fraught and difficult one, with little chance of a breakthrough. Guardian added rich and poor countries are at loggerheads as big economies have failed to cut greenhouse gas emissions quickly enough, and the poorer countries bearing the brunt of the climate crisis are receiving little of the financial assistance they need and that has been promised. The COP27 conference got off to a slow start, with negotiators spending more than 40 hours over the weekend wrangling over what would be on the agenda. In the end, it was agreed that the vexed issue of loss and damage, which refers to the worst impacts of the climate crisis, which are too severe for countries to adapt to, would be discussed. Poor countries suffering loss and damage want a financial mechanism that will give them access to funding when disasters such as hurricanes, floods, and droughts strike, destroying their infrastructure and tearing apart their social fabric. It is not likely that these talks will provide a final settlement on loss and damage, but countries are hoping for progress on ways of raising and dispersing finance. At most UN climate summits, activists and protesters play a key role. However, Egypt clamps down on dissent and its jails are full of political prisoners. Sisi's government has promised that climate activist voices will be heard, but their activities have been curtailed, with protesters kept at a separate site and required to register in advance to be granted permission for even minor demonstrations.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and oh God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. With me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the distinguishing factors or distinguishing characteristics of the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam is the amount, right now ignore the quality, but the quantity of sayings that are available from the household of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, and more especially from the first Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, that we see many different books in just compiling the sayings of one particular Imam or one particular personality takes up countless numbers of volumes. And not only that, it actually at times forms the core of the maktab of the sect. For example, we all know of a particular book that is known as Nahj al-Balagha. Nahj al-Balagha is one of the core texts that we as the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam refer to, especially in terms of historical anecdotes, historical kind of reference. It's the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. But there are other books as well that around the same time, the 5th, 6th century Hijri, that were also written in compiling, in gathering the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And hopefully, inshallah, today we will mention one of those other books that were responsible, or rather the scholar who took it upon himself to gather and compile the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage
particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters is a book that is titled Ghurl al-Hikam wa Durl al-Kalim. And the author is Qadi Nahs ad-Din Abu al-Fath Abdul al-Wahid ibn Muhammad al-Tamimi al-Amudi, or it is commonly known as al-Amudi for short. The book has been translated as The Exalted Aphorisms and Pearls of Speech, translated by dear brother Sheikh Dahir Rida Ja'far. It was published by Ansarian Publications in the holy city of Qum in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So again, just to add to what the Sheikh said, or just to confirm that this book was written again in the 6th century. The author, Al-Amudi, was a contemporary of great scholars such as Sayyid Radhi, who, as we know, was the compiler of Nahj al-Balagha, Sayyid Murtada, who was the great jurisprudent, the great scholar, and obviously Sheikh Tusi, who we know is the compiler of two of the main traditional or narrational books that we have, known as Al-Istibsar and Al-Tahdhib. Also, this book has two different publications in the original Arabic. One was the original that was set alphabetically, starting with Alif and going all the way down to Ya. And the second one, it changed the categorizing of the book from alphabetical order to subject-wise order. So it was changed in a manner that first it would be with what the word started with. So if the hadith of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam started with Alif, it would have started with that all the way. But now they've changed it to the title, or rather the subject that the hadith starts with. Or for example, if the hadith starts with Bakhl or Bukhl, which obviously means greediness, it will become the Al-Bukhl, and it will go. So it wouldn't be Ba, it will be Bukhl. So these are different prints of the book. Also, many different expositions in Arabic and Farsi exist. One of the famous ones in Farsi is done by Sheikh Khansari, which is a exposition done in 3 volumes in Farsi, going through or trying to explain as many of the aphorisms and short sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. It is also worthwhile saying and complimenting the Sheikh that this book contains the short sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The sayings don't go more than a line or two. So a lot of these things have been taken from longer traditions where the point of the Imam has been made clear. So please stay with us for our next segment, where we will be reading a couple of these traditions that are attributed, or rather may actually be from, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So for the benefit of our dear listeners, let us hear what the translator has to say about this book. Dear brother Sheikh Dahir Rida Ja'far.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in al-rajim, bismillahirrahman al-rahim. والحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين الحمد لله and praise be to Allah Azza wa Jal to have granted this humble soul the opportunity of translating one of the seminal works of hadith, which is known as غرر الحكم ودرر الكلم, which we have rendered into English as Exalted Aphorisms and Pearls of Speech. This is a work of the late 5th and early 6th century of the Hijrah, and it comprises of aphorisms and short sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which number just over 11,000. It is a work that contains words of wisdom and advice that can benefit everyone in their daily lives. And that is the reason why we embarked on translating this work, hoping that insha'Allah it will be a source of inspiration to all those who read it. We pray to Allah Azza wa Jal to accept this humble contribution in the English language. And may Allah Azza wa Jal increase our tawfiqat so that we are able to serve Him and His religion as much as possible. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa alihi al-tahirin.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. That was the translator of the book, our dear Sheikh Tahir Ridha Jafar. May Allah protect him and give him tawfiq to translate more worthy titles for the benefit of this English-speaking world. Again, the book that we introduced to our dear listeners is titled Ghurr al-Hikam wa Durr al-Kalim, a book that was written by Sheikh At-Tamimi Al-Amudi and translated by Sheikh Tahir Ridha Jafar. It is a book in which the author has compiled the short sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. But what we mean by short sayings is not that the Imam just said that the Imam on an occasion said a longer tradition, and the author has cut up that longer tradition at some occasion and has put it into a particular order. As we mentioned, the book has two different orders, one an alphabetical one, one a subject-wise one. So for the benefit of our dear listeners, we will read a portion from the section Jim, or rather where the subject is Jamal. And what is beautiful about this particular publication is that it has both the Arabic and the English. So on one side of the book, you have the original Arabic, the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, and then the translation of our dear Sheikh. So coming to Jamal or beauty, the first tradition, so there's six traditions here, we'll read one or two. So beauty, again, all these traditions go back to Imam Ali alayhi salam. External beauty is in possessing good looks. 2. Internal beauty is in possessing a good heart. 3. The beauty of a man is in his clemency. 4. The beauty of a man is dignity. 5. Beauty of the free man is in keeping away from dishonor. 6. The purity of beauty is in chastity. And then it goes on to the next topic, which is Jameel, the beautiful. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to go through this beautiful book, this compilation, the efforts that our great scholars have made and has reached us, and to take benefit from them, to use them, and to, more importantly, inculcate them in our daily lives. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.